the confrontation between Jesus and the leadership of the Jewish community, which we looked at in the earlier meditation, ends in, on a very poignant note. And for some reason I skipped it this morning accidentally. So I'll read it to you. It reads, "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it, how often have I desired to gather your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings. But you were not willing. See, your house is left to you, desolate. For I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, 'Blessed is the one who comes in the name of the Lord.'" And Matthew concludes that with by saying, "As Jesus came out of the temple and was going away, his disciples came to point out to him the buildings of the temple. Then Jesus asked them, 'You see all these, do you not? Truly I tell you, not one stone will be left upon another. It will all be torn down.'" Jesus can foresee the terrible state that's in the Roman occupation, the different groups vying for either to be on the side of the Romans or violently against them. And he can see that if this keeps going, it's going to lead to the destruction of this city and temple that he loved so much. And of course he was right. And by the time this gospel is written, they're living in the years just after it. And those words then lead us to this chapters 24 and 25 of the gospel. These two chapters are Matthew's fifth and final discourse, and they're a commentary on the final statement that I just read to you. From the beginning, Matthew has presented Jesus as Israel's shepherd Messiah. Here, in the final discourse, Matthew wants to reflect upon God's just verdict on the whole of human history. What they've seen happen in Jerusalem is just a sin, but what is history about? The ultimate day of the Lord, when God reveals who God is and the whole of history will stand before God's judgment. This judgment, we're going to see, is determined by the way we respond to our encounter with the Son of Man. So if you look at it schematically, we've seen the kingdom of God in action in the life of Jesus. We've seen a lot about discipleship of those who welcome the gift and then mediate it to others. And then we've just looked at the last meditation on the judgment of religion, what real religion is, and it's not the kind of stuff that we were dealing with among the Pharisees and scribes and so on. We're going to come tomorrow to the death of Jesus. And in the meantime, here in this position of the gospel, we're looking at the meaning of history as an encounter with the Son of Man. So it's kind of an ultimate look at what matters. And what's history all about? The experience that gave rise to this discourse, often called the eschatological discourse from the Greek eschaton, which means the final, ultimate thing, it appears to be the experience, because Matthew's borrowing it from Mark, the experience of Mark's community in Rome, of Nero's persecution, in which Peter and Paul were killed, and the Jewish war from 66 on. Mark's text is strongly influenced by the book of Daniel. That's where he gets his language from. And Matthew's community is reproducing, adapting, and expanding the material found in the eschatological discourse that you can find also in Mark. In regard to Matthew's text, it's especially difficult to say in which sections of the text the readers of this gospel, or the listeners listening to it proclaimed, they saw statements about the past, and some are clearly that. Sometimes they saw statements about their own experience, and that's clear. And sometimes they saw predictions of the future. And often it's a bit difficult to pick it up. It's Matthew's belief that at the moment of our death, Jesus will be present to each one of us. In that encounter, we'll be revealed for who we really are and for what we've chosen to become by the free choices we've made. And we don't judge other people, and some people have much more freedom to choose than others. We all know that. So this is not anything we can... But the idea is it matters what we do, and that's what we're judged on. Jesus, as the Son of Man, has identified with us in our human condition, especially in its fragility and suffering and oppression. He keeps coming up against that, and always his compassion, mercy, shows how God feels about all that oppression. He has identified with us, of course. The question is, have we identified with him? Have we heeded his words? Have we believed the good news and the choices we're making in life flowing from that belief? Well, each of us can only try to answer that. Beginning then are signs of the coming of the Son of Man and the end of the age, the end of the world. And it begins here in verse 3 of chapter 24. When Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, and they ask him two questions. One, tell us, when will all this take place that you've talked about, weeping over the city, if only you'd listened, etc.? When's it going to take place? And second question, what will be the sign of your coming? The Greek word is parousia, which you may pick up in your reading, and just means coming or presence. And of the end of the age. How will we know when you're coming to judge and that the world is coming to an end? How are we going to know that? Well, Matthew's community is no longer interested in when Jerusalem will be destroyed, because it seems to have already happened, but he's repeating Mark's gospel. Matthew includes this question since he found it in his source. It's the second question that interests Matthew and his community. What will be the sign that you are present and that history will stand before the judgment of God? First, there's a warning against false prophets. And help us, they're still around. Jesus answered them, "Beware that no one leads you astray. Many will come in my name saying, 'I'm the Messiah.'" The history of the church has been full of it. It's still happening, of course. "And they'll lead many astray." And then he talks about some things that are not signs of the parousia, of the presence or coming. "You'll hear of wars and rumours of wars. See that you're not alarmed." Yes, there will be wars and rumours of wars, yes, but the end is not yet. They're not signs of the coming. "For nation will rise against nation, sadly, and kingdom against kingdom. And there will be famines and earthquakes in various places." And where Jesus is, it's very prone to that. Turkey, well, Turkey's just had one recently, Izmir, because it's on the crossroads of a couple of plates of the earth. So this is a very volcanic, earthquake-prone area of the world. They're all familiar with it. Well, yes, there will be earthquakes in various places, but this is only the beginning of the birth pangs. Birth pangs, so it's about life. It's very positive. It's painful, but it's a birth pang. There'll be experiences of division in the community, which they've already experienced clearly. But that's not a sign either. "They will hand you over to tribulation and will put you to death, and you'll be hated by all nations because of my name, and many will fall away." No doubt some of the Christians in the community, of Matthew's community, gave it up. It was too hard. "And they'll betray one another and hate one another. Many false prophets will arise and lead many astray, and because of the increase of lawlessness, the love of many will grow cold." But it's the one who endures to the end who will be saved. Don't let your faith go. Don't let whatever pressure's coming shake you from what brought you into the Christian community, saying, "Whatever you made you my disciples, the kind of love you searched for, like the rich young man, who, please God, came back the next day and joined them." We don't know what happened the next day, but he went away sad from the encounter we have. So, okay, it's the one who endures to the end who'll be saved. "And this good news of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the world as a testimony to all the nations. And then the end will come, but not before the whole world has heard the good news. And when you see," I can't do this quickly, but I'll have to, "the desolating sacrilege standing in the holy place, as was spoken of by the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand. Then those in Judea must flee to the mountains." What that is we're going back now to the, it wasn't Daniel himself. Daniel's a prophet of the exile, and we know nothing about him except his name. But he becomes a symbol of a whole lot of stories about what matters and what being a good Jew is and not. So that's the book. But the book, most of the book was written only a couple of hundred years before Jesus, at the time of the Syrian invasion, when everything was, they went into the temple, and in the Holy of Holies, behind the curtain, they put a statue of Zeus, Baal, but it was the Eastern, but it was Zeus. So that was the putting a pagan idol in the place on the Ark of the Covenant, between the two cherubim, That's what the prophet Daniel, the book named after the prophet Daniel, talks about. So something similar has happened. It's the Roman occupation, it's the destruction of Jerusalem, etc. Those in Judea must flee to the mountains. The one on the housetop mustn't go down to take what is in the house. The one in the field must not turn back to get a coat. Woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing infants in those days. Pray that your flight may not be in winter or on a Sabbath. For at that time there will be great tribulation, such as has not been from the beginning of the world until now. No, and never will be. And if those days had not been cut short, no one would be saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. Then, if anyone says to you, look, here is the Messiah, because, or there he is, don't believe it, says Jesus. False messiahs and false prophets will appear and produce great signs and omens to lead astray, if possible, even those that God has chosen. Take note, I've warned you of this beforehand. So if they say to you, look, he's in the wilderness, the Messiah, don't go out. And if they say, look, he's in the inner rooms, don't believe them. So this must have been a pretty rampant kind of stuff going on in the first century, the latter part of the first century. And I'm not surprised because it's still going on. In spite of the fact that it's never right, there are groups that are so determined that now is the time, this is the time of judgment, and if you know your history, it's still going on. And it's madness, but we're very gullible to a populist speaker who's got some kind of magical, I don't know what, voice. However, this is the answer that Jesus gives to all that. As the lightning comes from the east and flashes as far as the west, so will the coming be of the Son of Man. No one can miss lightning flashing right across the sky. This is not going to be some obscure little thing the little coterie of people know about and force people to join them. No, no. When the Son of Man comes, it's going to be so obvious to everybody. So don't get sucked in by all this arcane special knowledge of a special group. Where the corpse is, that's where the vultures gather. So just as you know where the corpse is by seeing where the birds, the vultures are gathering, so the coming of the Son of Man will be as clear and obvious as that. I'll leave the book of Daniel because it's so complex. Immediately after the suffering of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from the heaven, and the powers of heaven will be shaken. This is all dramatic language taken from the prophets. Here's Isaiah, for example, chapter 13. The stars of the heavens and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be dark at its rising. The moon will not shed its light. This is dramatic language that they're used to. Here we have Isaiah chapter 34. All the host of heaven shall rot away, and the skies roll up like a scroll. All their host shall wither, says Isaiah centuries before. 800 years before Jesus. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven. And then All the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they'll see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven, taken straight out of the book of Daniel, with power and great glory. And he will send out his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. But just to show how that language comes from the book of Daniel, I'll read you chapter 7 of Daniel. As I watched, says the, I suppose you could call him a prophet, it's harder, or the poet anyhow, as I watched in the night visions, I, says Daniel, inverted commas, I saw one like a human being, like a son of man actually, coming with the clouds of heaven. And he came to the anointed one, the ancient one, who was present before him. The ancient one is God. And he's looking into the, seeing a vision, but he's actually talking about people's lives. And there's someone up there, and in the book of Daniel, that someone up there, that Son of Man that appears, is a symbolic representation of us, of the poor, broken, oppressed Jews, whom the Syrians are actually killing and murdering and hacking and etc. And they're afraid. Well, says the writer of the book of Daniel, wait a minute, no, you're going to be the ones that come out on top in all this, not them. Here's Paul's language in 1 Thessalonians, one of his earliest letters written in the year 50. He writes, the Lord himself will descend from heaven. So they're using dramatic language to try and get at something. The Lord himself, that's Yahweh, will descend from heaven, and the dead in Christ will rise first. Then we who are alive, says Paul. So can you see he's expecting this to happen very soon? That's why he's such a hurry to get through to Europe and wants to go to Spain as well. Because it's all going to happen because the resurrection is happening. The first stalks of wheat are up. Well, all the rest are going to be ready soon. So we better get on with it. We who are alive, we, some of the Thessalonians maybe, and Paul, will be caught up in the clouds together with them to meet the Lord in the air. And so we will be with the Lord forever. Paul's using the same apocalyptic literature that he gets from the prophets. But look at the whole point he's making. What about, whatever about all that language, the point is we're going to meet the Lord. And we will be with the Lord, that's Jesus, forever. Like Yahweh, the Son of Man, the exalted Jesus, is enthroned on the clouds, a very common image. Here's Psalm 104. You see the beams of your chambers in the waters. You make the clouds, says the psalmist to God, your chariot. You ride on the wings of the wind. You make the winds your messengers, fire and flame your ministers. Dramatic, poetic, musical language used all through the Bible, and it comes into this passage too. So we've got to get behind, or not behind, but we've got to depth the language to try to get to the essence of it, and we will in a few minutes. The whole passage will come out very clearly. Book of Revelations, chapter 1. Look, says the author of that, John, he's coming with the clouds. Every eye will see him, even those who pierced him. And on his account, all the tribes of the earth will wail. Why didn't we get the message? We've just seen Jesus weeping over the city. Why didn't you listen? Well, they're not the only ones who weren't listening. We can not listen. the author I've referred to a few times, Lewis, writes, there'll be no more signs that will give people a last-minute warning. That is a hoax proclaimed only by the false prophets. The only sign is the Son of Man himself. Jesus is the one who identifies with the poor and the broken and the blind and the lame and the excluded. That'll be the only sign. A very gentle sign, by the way. Come to me, all you who labour and are burdened, I'm gentle, etc. He will appear suddenly and as unmistakably as a lightning bolt in the sky, and the surprised nations of the earth will wail when they see him coming with the clouds of heaven and have to face up to the fact that they'd missed the whole point and they'd been destructive and silly and violent and all the rest of it. From the fig tree, learn this lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts forth its leaves, we've talked about the fig tree earlier, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see all these things, you know that he's near at your very gates. Truly, I tell you, this generation, Jesus' generation, will not pass away until all these things have taken place. So whatever we've been talking about for the last 30 verses, it's all going to take place in the generation Jesus is speaking to. So don't let it get too out of... It's all going to happen, and it's got... Surely that's a reference to what we're going to start looking at tomorrow, the death and resurrection of Jesus. A year or two after this. Heaven and earth will pass away. Yes, there will be an end, but my words will not. But about that day, this back to their question, when's it going to happen? About that day and that hour, no one knows, says Jesus. The angels don't know, and I don't know, says Jesus. The Son doesn't know, only the Father. So if people think they know, this text surely tells us to stop being stupid. As in the days of Noah, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in those days, and Noah's not a real historical figure, of course, he's a dramatic person to make a point in that wonderful story of the flood. As in the days of Noah, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day Noah entered the ark. And they knew nothing until the flood came and swept them all away. So too will be the coming of the Son of Man. Then two will be in the field, one will be taken and one will be left. Two women will be grinding meal together and one will be taken and one left. That's life experience in many parts of the world. I guess that's what's happening in Izmir now. Keep awake, therefore. You don't know on what day your Lord is coming. But understand this. If the owner of the house had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have stayed awake and would not have let his house be broken into, of course. Therefore, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an unexpected hour. Who then, we're getting close now to Jesus' response to it all, who then is the faithful and wise slave whom his master has put in charge of his household to give the other slaves their allowance of food at the proper time? Blessed is that slave whom the master will find at work when he arrives. Truly, I tell you, he'll put that person in charge of all his possessions. But if that wicked slave says to himself, my master is delayed, and he begins to beat his fellow servants and eats and drinks with drunkards, the master of the slave will come on a day when he doesn't expect, and at an hour that he doesn't know, he will cut him in pieces and put him with the hypocrites, where there'll be weeping and grinding of teeth. And on that point of being alert, attentive, waiting, comes this story you know so well. I'll just read it. The kingdom of heaven is like this, says Jesus. 10 bridesmaids took their torches. There's the Greek word from which we get the word lamp. The torches, and went to meet the bridegroom. So we're back into a wedding banquet. 5 of them were foolish. 5 were sensible. And when the foolish took their torches, they took no oil with them. But the wise took flasks of oil with their torches. And as the bridegroom was delayed, all they became drowsy and fell asleep. But at midnight, there was a shout. Look, here's the bridegroom coming. Come, meet him. Then all of those bridesmaids got up and trimmed their torches. And the foolish said to the wise, look, give us some of your oil, for our torches are going out. The wise one said, look, sorry, but there's not enough for all of us. You'll have to go and buy some. Won't last the night. And while they went to buy it, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went with him into the wedding banquet. And the door was shut. Later, the other bridesmaids came, said, Lord, Lord, open to us. And these terrible words, heavens. But he replied, truly, I tell you, I do not know you. The lesson is clear, and it concludes, so keep awake, for you don't know the day or the hour. And he tells another story, which you know, about the talents and how many of them used them well and many of them just wasted. They didn't live their life. It was an unlived life they lived, to be safe, to be secure. And you know the story so well, I won't go into it with you. Verse 31 of chapter 25. When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, it's imagery, of course, he'll sit on the throne of his glory, and all the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate people one from another, as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he'll put the sheep on his right hand and the goats on the left. So it's behaviour that must have gone on at the time. Then the king will say to those at his right hand, so it's a story, but we can read into it Jesus and God. When the king, he'll say, come, you that are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. We all know this so well, but you can't read it too often. I was thirsty, and it was you who gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you gave me clothing. I was sick, and you took care of me. I was in prison, and you visited me. Then the ones to whom Jesus has been, the king has been speaking, they'll say, Lord, when was it that we saw you hungry and gave you food, or thirsty and gave you something to drink? When was it that we saw you a stranger and welcomed you, or naked and gave you clothing? When was it that we saw you sick and in prison and visited you? And the king will answer, truly I tell you, just as you did it to one of the least of these members of my family, you were doing it to me. Jesus identifies with everybody, of course, but so especially with the poor and the children and the simple and the loving and the ordinary members of his family. And then the terrible bit, really, he'll say to those on his left, you are accursed. Depart from me into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, and you didn't welcome me. Naked, and you didn't give me clothing. Sick, in prison, and you didn't visit me. It's very hard reading that, isn't it, as an Australian? Some of you may not be. I find it hard to read as an Australian in the light of the way we've treated asylum seekers. And maybe we haven't been angry enough about it. Maybe we haven't demonstrated enough about it. Maybe we haven't made those who make the decisions more accountable. I won't go any further into it, but there's plenty of people who could be saying this to us as a country, as a community. They'll answer, I didn't see you on Tampa, the boat, or whatever. Lord, when was it that we saw you hungry and thirsty, or a stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, and didn't care of you? And he'll say, truly I tell you, just as you didn't do it to one of the least of these, you didn't do it to me. And that group, it's self-inflicted, of course, will go away to eternal punishment, but the others into eternal life. A comment by Lewis, the other author writing this, into the midst of a seemingly apocalyptic outline of history of the end time, Matthew inserts a long exhortatory section that makes up about half of the two chapters. The only purpose of this section is to call the church to watchfulness in view of the coming judgment. That is, to love, to active preparedness in view of the parousia. When Matthew repeatedly speaks of judgment in parables, he wants to make judgment a central reality in the lives of his readers He wants to shake people up, to change them, to lead them to new life. And no one says that any of this is easy. The person that most attracted me, and so what in a way, but was Angela Merkel, who, and a lot of what she did didn't bear fruit because other people wouldn't come along with it, as I see it anyhow, but she at least tried to be open to all this. God bless her. And Lewis goes on, for Matthew, the enabling foundations of his theology is not apocalyptic eschatology, but it's about Jesus, God with us in history, in the poor and the naked and the imprisoned and so on. The apocalyptic dimension of his eschatology only helps to indicate what the consequences are for life and death, and what it means for the future of the entire world, that in the midst of the world, God is with us. What we choose to do matters. And I'll conclude with a piece of music. I am with you. And then tomorrow, we'll just have one talk in the morning, not two, at 9, and the next day just one at 9. Well, perhaps to... I was going to say, I've talked too much. Well, I probably have, but I've tried to get through the whole gospel, and that's my reason. But a bit more time and ease as we go into the most sacred section of Matthew's gospel. So enjoy this and hear Jesus saying, I'm with you, through his Spirit.